there. Just before we get into this podcast, I wanted to say a quick thank you very much to two of our listeners, that's Richard Goldstone and Bob Morrison, for making donations in order to keep the Dad's Army podcast going. It's donations like this that really do get ploughed straight back into the production costs of the podcast and ensure its future. So thanks ever so much, Richard, and thank you, Bob. If you'd like to make a donation to the podcast, then you can do so by visiting our webpage, which is www.dadsarmypodcast.com, and clicking on the donate button.
Who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler, if you think we're on the run?
Yes, hello, and welcome to episode 45 of the Dad's Army podcast. I'm joined once again by Oliver. Hello, Oliver.
Hello, my friend. It's good to be back.
It is indeed. It feels like we haven't recorded one of these things for a long time, actually.
It's been far too long. I've had withdrawal symptoms.
So what have we got coming up then over the next... Well, this will probably be about an hour or so. We're going to visit the Dad's Army newsroom. There we are.
Oh, yes.
I've just created a virtual newsroom.
I'll tell you what, the decor is fantastic.
It's a nice newsroom.
It is. Like newsroom. It's very, very classic.
We've got quite a few pieces of news to go through this time. It's remarkable, really, how much does actually happen in the world of Dad's Army when you actually pay attention and keep an eye out for it, really. We have got an absolute bulging post bag to go through. So, once again, we're going to address your feedback on your emails. Thank you very much indeed to absolutely everybody who's bothered to send in feedback. It's really, really good. A little bit later on, we have a very special guest joining us to have a discussion all about the man and the hour. So without any further ado, let's get on with the news.
Here is the news, and this is John Snagg reading it.
David Croft has got a new website.
Okey-dokey.
Which I have to say surprised me somewhat, because it's an incredibly modern, very snazzy looking website. Lots of moving things.
Yeah, okay.
On the front page. Have you managed to take a look at it yet?
Well, I saw it some months ago, so I have a feeling you're going to tell me it's been updated since then.
Oh, it might have done, because I only took a detailed look at it this afternoon.
Right.
So I don't know what it was like a couple of months or so ago. But there's an awful lot about David. There's a little bit of a biog, as you would expect. There's an introduction from David himself, and lots of rather cleverly segmented pieces of information concerning his career. So you've got a collaborations page that details all the work that he did with Jimmy Perry, for instance.
Yeah.
Another just as detailed section for the work that he undertook with Jeremy Lloyd.
Yeah.
But I have to say, by far and away, the most impressive part of this website is one of the Dad's Army games.
Dad's Army games, eh?
Think Space Invaders.
Yeah.
With Captain Mannerin as your ship firing at the Nazi gas masks.
Well, that is something I didn't expect you to tell me about.
Was that not on the original version? It's quite an interesting game, I have to say. It's nothing, you know, incredibly novel or original. It's just an interesting take on the traditional Space Invaders game. But every time you happen to lose a life, and you're not shot at by aliens, you have a swastika dropped on you.
Wow.
And if it happens to...
I wonder what eBay would say about that.
That's a very good point. But if a swastika happens to hit Captain Mannerin, then a small caricature of Jones comes along, grabs him and takes him off.
Really?
It's the most bizarre game, I have to say. It made me smile.
That's good.
But I then kind of exited that part of the website and moved on very quickly. But in all honesty, and all joking aside, it is a very, very detailed website. And it's got a significant amount... Well, it's got the most amount of information about David Croft I've seen in one place. Certainly in a web page.
Yeah.
But you can go and visit that website. That's davidcroft.co.uk. And David Croft is also on Twitter.
Is he really?
He is on Twitter, so you can follow him on Twitter.
What a legend.
It's quite amazing. I'm certain that both the website and his Twitter account are managed.
Yeah.
In reality, I just can't see David Croft sitting at his computer tweeting.
No.
But you never know. You never know. It's worth checking out the website. Go and take a look.
You're listening to the Dad's Army podcast with your host, James.
Well, an organisation is a charity called the Heritage Foundation. They are keen associates with the world of Dad's Army, Heidi High. This is mainly down to Croft and Perry, who are very, very big members within this organisation. On Sunday the 7th, they held a very special tribute to Geoffrey Holland. Now, Geoffrey Holland is, of course, very well known for his role as Spike Dixon in Heidi High, as James Twelvetrees in Urang Lord, and many other wonderful things. He, of course, made his Dad's Army debut in the very final season of the show, playing an army officer. I mean, there were all sorts of people, with Sue Pollard was there, and Paul Shane, Donald Hewlett, Michael Knowles, Frank Williams, Ronnie Grange. You know, it was a very wonderful day, and I'm very honoured to say that I went along. And the reason we're talking about this is that the next Heritage do, coming up in the calendar soon, is a Perry and Croft special. And Jimmy Perry and David Croft were both present at Geoff Holland's do, and Jimmy went up on stage and gave a very very nice talk about Geoff and how they've always been big fans of his work. And so it was a very nice day. And so the Perry and Croft do, it's coming up in the near future. Tickets will be on sale soon. So you can check out the Heritage Foundation's website for more information.
Just let me ask you a couple of questions about this. I'm assuming the format of each of these do's, if you like, is more or less the same. So presumably dinner is included, you get speeches. I mean, how does it actually work?
The format, it can vary, actually. I've been to two. The Geoffrey Holland one was very different, actually. There was a magician. He went on far too long, in fact. and you had a young singer. You had Sue Pollard singing a very unique song, which I can't possibly divulge about because it was too rude. Paul Shane doing a bit of singing. You know, we were loving that.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, there's auctions for charity and all that kind of stuff. And they have lots of, you know, well-known faces there. Vicky Michelle, she did a speech, obviously, because Geoffrey Holland did the LOLO tour recently. But yeah, I mean, it's a great opportunity for obviously fans of the show. I mean, it's a pricey sort of affair, you know. But there are indeed fans walking around and getting. Frank was signing DVD covers and books all day long, you know. So it's certainly it's quite an amazing. I got to meet Philip Maddock, which was an enormous thrill, and what a lovely man he is. So it was a great, great pleasure. You know, for fans of comedy, there are amazing days out.
Okay, you may remember a couple of years ago we interviewed Stuart Wright on the podcast, and he told us all about the plans to erect a permanent homage to Arthur Lowe / Captain Mannering in Thetford in the form of a statue. Now, at the time, I mean, you hear lots of stories about these initiatives that get launched, but basically come to nothing purely because funding just kind of disappears. Now, Stuart and the people up at the Dad's Army Museum in Thetford have been remarkably persistent in their aims, and they've managed to achieve the funding. They've commissioned a sculptor, and this week I've seen, I'm not quite entirely certain whether it was announced this week, but I've seen them this week, a very, very small version of what is going to be unveiled in Thetford at the Bressingham weekends in June this year. So I've actually seen, and anyone can go and see if you Google it, a very small statue of Arthur Lowe sitting on a bench.
Wonderful.
And now this was talked about a little bit at last year's Dad's Army Appreciation Society members' meal, where Jimmy Perry got up and he told a story that involved talking about how strong a supporter of the Conservative Party Arthur Lowe was. And there's another statue in Thetford, and it has been for many, many years, that of Thomas Paine.
Oh, yes.
The chap who invented socialism. So it's going to be rather interesting for Arthur Lowe to be immortalised, you know, within spitting distance of the chap who represents everything that he didn't advocate politically.
Have they decided on a location for the statue?
I believe they have. Yeah. I believe they have. I mean, Thetford town centre is very small anyway, so it's not going to be somewhere out in the sticks. It's going to be somewhere probably in the high street, I would guess. Mm. I'll probably get an angry Stuart now emailing saying, no, it's going to be somewhere else. But I'm going to be there, as you are, aren't you? You're going to be there in June to see the unveiling of that statue.
For anyone who hasn't been to Thetford, it really is one of the nicest places I've ever been to. I mean, the fact, obviously, that it's got an association with Dad's Army is a huge bonus. But when I went with Frank and Mervyn Cumming and I filmed his documentary, we didn't want to go. We wanted to just spend the day in Thetford because it's such a nice place. And on that day, we had cross weather because the sun came out and it was the middle of November. Yeah. And it was such a beautiful day. But it's a really special place. So if anyone out there listening who hasn't been, go along, because there's something quite special when you realise you're standing where the Home Guard once stood along some of the locations. Mm. And Stuart Wright is a wonderful man and has done an enormous amount for Dad's Army in the area. And he's got a great Dad's Army trail you can go on and see all the locations. And he's very knowledgeable. So it promises to be a good day out. But yeah, Bressingham is going to be very exciting.
I think Bressingham's going to be very exciting this year for a number of reasons. And we mentioned it in a podcast we recorded a couple of months or so ago. The Bressingham event has reached its 10th anniversary, or is reaching its 10th anniversary this year, and as such they're doing something rather special, and we're going to have Paul back on the show in a couple of months' time to give us an official preview. But we do know the dates. It's going to be the weekend of the 20th of June, and once again I haven't got my diary with me, so I can't tell you whether that's a Saturday or a Sunday, but I know the 20th of June is definitely one of the days there's going to be events taking place. And as Oliver says, the first time a Dad's Army fan goes to Thetford, it is remarkable because some of the locations simply haven't changed. No. They're instantly recognisable. And very few places used in TV shows 20, 30 years ago are recognisable at all. It takes a considerable amount of imagination to try and put yourself back in the surroundings as they were when they were filmed, but not so with Thetford.
And particularly the wonderful thing with Thetford is it's all in walking distance.
Yeah.
And, you know, we used throughout the series, you know, something like, you know, Doctor Who has been filmed all over the place. You'd struggle to ever get around all of those in a day. I mean, yeah, Thetford's a really nice place, so yeah, come along, come and meet us.
Have you logged on to the Perry and Croft Forum yet? Well, if you are a fan of Jimmy Perry and David Croft's programmes and you haven't taken a look, then you are missing out. But don't panic, you can still join the thriving online community who discuss every conceivable aspect of Dad's Army, Urang Milord, Heidi High and many others at perryandcroft.co.uk, and click on the link to the forum.
And the Home Guard are marching on. Dad's Army marches on as the stage show has returned. Leslie Grantham is back as Private Walker for you EastEnders fans out there. Yeah, they're back on tour.
Mm. Yeah, this week, I think. It was either this week or last week, they launched again at Stevenage. And they're performing four classic episodes. We've talked about it before, but we'll go through them quickly again. It's Mum's Army, Branded, The Two and a Half Feathers, and Keep Young and Beautiful. So some good episodes there. The thing is, every time I end up talking about this production with Dad's Army fans, there's always usually a slight air of consternation, because clearly we're talking about new actors taking the part of actors that we, you know, hold very, very dear.
Yes.
In our affection when we consider Dad's Army. And I think for diehard fans, seeing this particular production can be quite hard sometimes.
Mm.
And I don't think that the passionate fans are the target audience. I think it's far more people who remember the show with a bit of fondness and just want to go back and see some really funny lines reenacted.
Yeah.
However, having said that, I would still recommend to go and see this show. It's being produced by the same production company who launched this in 2007 and relaunched it again in 2008. They do pay particularly care in terms of getting the script correct. And some of the actors who they've got portraying these characters are very, very good. And you can see that they have studied the original actors in trying to emulate and just bring the characters to life. I think they succeed to a degree with some characters, and they probably a little bit left wanting on others.
Yeah.
But given the fact that I don't think a ticket costs more than £20 for the entire 21 or 22 different locations they're playing at throughout the country, it's not money wasted. And if nothing else, I think Calibre are doing a fantastic job in keeping the spirit of Dad's Army alive in this new and modern way in the 21st century. So
absolutely, and I'd like to go and watch. I didn't see the previous ones, so I think I think the podcast should go and represent Warmington on Sea one night and be good to go and watch it.
It would be superb. I mean, I am going along to the Chelmsford showing. I'm going on the afternoon, going on the matinee. By all means, if you're going to the Chelmsford showing, you know, drop us an email and we'll see if we can record your thoughts about the production afterwards, perhaps.
We've had lots of wonderful feedback lately, and thank you very much for everyone who's emailed in. We're going to read a few of them out now. I'm going to start off with one from Nick. Hello, James. He read my email out on my last podcast. I think this is referring to me. So I'm Oliver. Hello, Nick. I've watched all Frank's stuff on his YouTube page. Good actor. I wish he'd done some of those cult TV 70s shows now. Well, have you know, he did quite a few cult stuff. It was a wonderful Monty Python episode that Frank was in. When you actually look at Frank's CV, he did an enormous amount of work, and there's a fair few gems out there. So but thank you for looking on the YouTube page. I think Frank will be popping a few more. Maybe Frank will get on Twitter as well, following David Cross' footsteps. That'll be pretty fun. But Nick continues, I'm going to Worthing on the 13th of March to see the stage play. I wonder what changes will be made this time. He continues, I want a Dad's Army movie poster from those stupid boys at eBay. I got the game for £10 2 years ago. When is the next Dad's Army podcast? All the best, Nick. Well, the next Dad's Army podcast, you'll be pleased to know,
is now.
He's right now.
You're listening to it. Yeah. No, I did send Nick a quick email back just to say the next podcast should be out fairly soon. And it's a little bit later this month, I'm afraid, than I wanted it to be. But that's mainly because it is quite a lengthy one, and editing takes quite a significant amount of time up. But yeah, suggesting your other points, you mentioned the stupid boys at eBay. I mean, we talked about that story on the last podcast briefly. And I still think it's quite interesting because Richard Littlejohn wrote a piece in the Daily Mail about that particular story. I won't read it out now, but it's worth Googling if you're interested in reading it. Richard Littlejohn's quite a well-known, respected TV presenter, journalist, and he's a very, very big Dad's Army fan. And anyway, that gets off the point a little bit. You mentioned Frank on Twitter. I was just thinking in my head at the time, I was thinking Vicar Twitter.
Vicar Twitter?
Vicar Twitter, that's a really good name that he could use.
That's fantastic.
You can Vicar pass that Twitter on to him if you
like. I certainly will. I shall let Frank know, but yeah, why not? Why not?
Our next email is from a chap called Michael Curtis. Thank you, Michael, for sending in your email. Hi, James. Top job on a podcast. Really like the commentary episodes. And I have to say, a lot of our feedback at the moment has been very positive about our commentary episodes. Which is really good news for me, because ultimately all we do is turn a telly on, turn a recorder on, and just have a chat.
Very highlight for me. I mean, it's wonderful talking about Dad's Army, but when you can sort of, in a way, have the boys in the same room as you and watch them, and it is good fun. And of course, you get to watch them while you're listening to us, so which has got to be for the better.
I was going to say, you have to pick up on the downsides of it. But there you go. Anyway, Michael continues, I have the pilot of Isoham. I think he means It Sticks Out Half a Mile.
Oh, right, okay.
But yeah. I like Isoham.
Isoham,
it's a really good acronym.
Isoham.
Arthur Lowe does indeed sound drunk in it, but as you said, this was due to his medication. You've just had a listen to the first
one. I listened to it literally on the afternoon of this recording. I found it on YouTube, would you believe? So, you know, perhaps you will stumble across it as well. Yeah, it was a weird listen, I have to say. It was nice in a way because it was... It was very poignant because you knew it was the last thing Arthur did with Captain Mannering. To me, he didn't sound drunk. He just sounded old, bless him, you know. But at least he was there and giving it a go. So as far as I'm concerned, for me, it was just nice to sort of get a little hint of a Dad's Army sequel. And I liked it, you know, the banter with, you know, them describing each other before going in to meet each other. I thought it was nice. So it's definitely worth a listen. I was also looking at The Man of the Hour, the very first episode, earlier on as well. And just how sort of you know, the lines flowed, and you could really hear the difference as time had gone on. But that happens to us all, I think.
Yeah, it does indeed. I've just got one question really arising from that, Oliver. Why did you listen to just half of it?
Oh, well, half a stick. I was listening to it at work. So, I have the second half of the pilot to listen to. They've just got to the pier.
I have to say, actually, thank you to everyone who's offered me a copy of It Sticks Out Half a Mile. I think I've said a couple of times now, the only one I haven't heard in its entirety is the pilot, and that is the case. I have actually now got a copy, but I haven't got round to listening to it yet. But I think what we'll do is we'll take a listen. When you, Oliver, get around to listening to the second half of that,
yep,
and I've got round to listening to it, we'll do a very quick mini-review, perhaps, in a future podcast.
I think absolutely.
Okay. Anyway, sorry, Michael, I'm spending a very long time getting through your email here. On another note, I used to work with someone here that was a Sea Scout in one of the episodes. He said it was great fun, and Clive Dunn bought them fish and chips.
That's lovely, isn't it?
I like that. I do like that, yeah. I wonder if he bought every Sea Scout fish and chips. Because there was quite a lot in some of those episodes.
A friend of mine at work told me today that his friend brought up Jean-Claude Van Damme's luggage to his hotel room, and he gave him £1,000 for the privilege. That's not a bad tip.
No, not at all. No, that's fish and chips, that kind of looks a bit measly now, in the context of that story.
I wouldn't mind a fish and chips either. Yeah.
If he ever comes back to work here, I will try and get you in contact with him. All the best, Michael. Michael, thank you very much indeed for your email.
Thank you, and I've got one now from Bob Pryor. Hi, thanks for the podcast. Great listening. I've been into Dad's Army since it was first broadcast. You can see I'm over 21. Some of my memories may interest you. Trying to book tickets for the stage show at the Theatre Royal Bath many years ago, only to find the best seats gone and being offered a stage box. My wife and myself being the only ones in a box. Wonderful moments. Pike as a banana. And the cast bowing to the box at the end as well as the audience. Did we have red faces? I met Arthur and his wife one afternoon on board Amazon, his steam yacht, here in Ramsgate. Mm. Nice people. Wow.
That's quite an amazing line.
That's a fantastic thing. Yeah. Also meeting John Lemesurier a number of times here in the town, and of course his wife Joan is still here. John's ashes were laid to rest in our local churchyard. One point I'd like to make, in Never Too Old, I think it would have been nice if the warden had stood with him at the end rather than the sad words he finished with. What good would you have been? What do you think about that? I mean, I sort of think, well, it's true to character. I agree with what you mean. It would have been nice to have a nice happy ending, but to me, the real essence, we started with the Home Guard, we finished with the Home Guard. Just a shame Jimmy Beck wasn't there. It's the only downside for me in that lineup at the end.
Mm. No, I have to say I agree with you. And I know what Bob means, because some of the warm, fuzzy moments I get within Dad's Army are, for instance, in Wake Up Warmington or All Is Safely Gathered In, where you get a slightly different warden who's more cooperative with Manor M.
Yes.
And I think the temptation for the writers would have been to make everybody all kind of friends in the end. But I think you also have to remember that it wasn't the end of the war. Despite it being the end of Dad's Army, there was still a war to be fought. They'd already established Hodge's character as being either manic, completely difficult, sometimes deliberately so, and I think it would have been completely out of character for them to suddenly say, yeah, you're part of the platoon as well. I'm very glad they ended it the way that they did.
Yeah.
And whilst I appreciate Bob's sentiment, I'm glad they didn't go that way. I think it would have been a rather obvious way to go. I'm glad that they were able to orchestrate a slightly emotional ending because of it.
And I think it strengthened the bond with platoon, like Fraser saying, I'll be standing right beside you, Jonesy. You know, normally those two are bickering. Yeah. But here, they had that mutual, you know, that mutual rival with Hodges. And so it strengthened them for that very last scene. But
that's a very, very good point, actually. I don't think it would have been as, what's the word, communal within that's a terrible word,
united,
actually.
They
wouldn't have been as united had Hodges not just given them all quite a nasty jab.
Yeah.
And it's also the only time Mannerin ever calls Jones Jonesy.
Yes. That's a wonderful moment.
It is.
It really is special.
I wonder if it's a misreading from Arthur Lowe's lines, but let's say not.
We'll have to look at the script. Bob continues, I'm running a World War II museum collection and the Ramsgate Home Guard. If I've learnt one thing, the Home Guard were mostly made up of very young and old men, and a thing of fun to a large number of people at the time, and would not have lasted more than a short time in the face of the German troops, but to a man would have stood and died to defend their homes and loved ones. And that's wonderful. And that comes across in Dad's Army. Thank you to them all, both real and TV. Best wishes, Bob Pryor from Ramsgate.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Bob.
Yeah.
And, I'd like to think the Home Guard would have done their best in this situation.
I think there's no question of that. But I think the last paragraph of Bob's message is absolutely spot on. They were a subject of ridicule, and that is reflected in Dad's Army, particularly in Wake Up Warmington, where most people see the Home Guard as a joke because they were constantly going on about being prepared for an invasion that never happens. Mm. So again, it's just another testament, really, to the realities of Perry and Cross Scripps. Okay, moving on to our next email. This is from Dennis Buds from Brisbane, Australia. Thanks for your email, Dennis. James, I really enjoyed the podcast, and thank you and your team for putting all of the effort into keeping Dad's Army alive. As a Dad's Army fan and military collector of many years, I have spotted something that may be of interest to you and your listeners. I wonder if you have ever noticed that Captain Mannerin's uniform, at least in the colour episodes, is a slightly different shade of green than the rest of the cast. In fact, Mannerin is wearing a Canadian battle dress and tunic. The Canadian battle dress was a much darker shade of green than its British counterpart. What gives it away is the design of the metal buttons, which are quite distinct. It was not unusual during the war for British officers to seek out and acquire Canadian uniforms, as they were of much better quality. So it is completely possible that the posh Mannerin would have done so too.
Absolutely. That's wonderful, isn't it?
It's fascinating.
I totally believe that Mannerin would have... Well, I'll get one of those Canadian uniforms.
Yeah, but I had no idea. I mean, I've probably mentioned in the past, I'm colourblind anyway, and it's not the kind of detail that I notice. So I have to say, I'm really grateful to you, Dennis, for bringing that to my attention. I will certainly pay attention in future to see if there is a difference in shade. Dennis finishes up. I've just finished watching War Dance a few minutes ago. This is a terrific episode that really gets a mention. Once again, Mannerin is excellent as a tipsy drunk, but this time with a black eye. He says, courtesy of the linen cupboard. I give it 3.5 stars. I love War Dance. One of my favourites, again, mainly because the Wilson-Pike relationship is under scrutiny there. Especially, you know, Mannering calling Wilson Peter Pan, and etc. And Wilson stabs back. Yeah, but I love that episode. I think that's one we're going to have to talk about soon, I think.
Let's do a commentary.
Well, why not? Okay, there you are, Dennis.
Just for you, Dennis.
Just because you gave it a mention, we will give it a commentary. Watch out in a couple of months' time.
Now a very short but sweet one from Gareth Kays. Hi, James. I hope you are well. Just been catching up on the last two episodes of the podcast, which I enjoyed very much. The whole podcast runs like a smooth, well-oiled machine. Oh. Anyway, looking forward to the next instalment, and we hope you are enjoying it, Gareth. Thank you very much for emailing.
Okay, now, Oliver read out a message a few moments ago from Bob in Ramsgate.
Yep.
By some coincidence, Robin Knight in Adelaide, Australia, was thinking along exactly the same lines. Hi, James. In the last few weeks, I have just discovered the Dad's Army podcast, and I'm in the process of downloading past episodes. What a treat. I particularly loved hearing the voices of surviving cast members recorded at functions and in interviews. I've been a fan since growing up in the 70s. One of my great memories is of my late father, is of him crying with laughter at Arthur Lowe as a swearing sergeant in The 2.5 Feathers. And I have subsequently become something of a student of the show's history and the lives of the actors. So it's great to learn even more and reflect on your discussions through the podcasts. Now, this is the part that, as I said, I think, Bob, you'll be interested in. I would love to hear your thoughts, Robin says, on Never Too Old, particularly the final scene. I have often thought that a reconciliation between the Warden and the platoon might have been a nice ending and given the end of the series a little more warmth. There had previously been hints of cooperation previously, if I remember, in All Is Safely Gathered In and Wake Up Warmington. I wondered why I suddenly had that information so readily to hand in my mind. There we go. The moment between Jonesy and Mrs. Fox, in brackets, Mrs. Jones, when we realise that she may have had a darker motive for the marriage, is perfect, I think. But I have also been vaguely uncomfortable about the what good would you be against real soldiers moment. But having said that, it did set up a perfect expression of platoon unity and collective courage. Now, I've got to be honest with you, I didn't remember Robin had sent this email in at all when we were having that conversation a little moment ago. But it is quite, well, it's an amazing coincidence.
Oh, it is
really
fascinating. All us Dad's Army fans are thinking alike. The Home Guard are heroes, as far as I'm concerned. So, yeah, you don't. But, I mean, Hodges is the guy we love to hate at the end of the day. You know, he is there for that whole purpose. And I agree that the comment isn't nice. But at the same time, I think Perry and Croft would have sold out if he'd been there saying, oh, you know, put your arm around me, Mr. Wilson, you know, let's go for a pint. It wouldn't have happened, you know. That final scene is very poignant and it's very moving. But, you know, we had to believe that life carried on in Warmington-on-Sea. I have an email here from Richard Goldstone. I hope I've pronounced that right, Richard. Hello, James. Just finished listening to the latest podcast. Very enjoyable as usual. I am very much looking forward to the Jones episode. Perhaps... hey! Perhaps someone could stand behind you with a bayonet to make sure you don't say too many bad things about Jonesy. After all, they don't like it, etc., etc. Interesting, you were talking about Dad's Army on Goodnight Sweetheart. I've just watched the episode in question on YouTube and wasn't impressed too much. I think it was a poor gimmick to use it in another show, and the actors had neither the style nor mannerisms of the original. Whoever looked, though, was a bit of Dad's Army trivia. I agree entirely. I saw it on the night James and I first met at the BFI, and I thought it was very weak, to be fair. It just like, you know, a sitcom, I think I've said this before, a sitcom cashing in off another sitcom, you know. You wouldn't have Del Boy going into a hotel and watching four people rowing with each other, you know, for like 5 minutes. It wouldn't happen, so...
That's an exceptionally good idea. I'd quite like to see that. I'd watch it.
Yeah. You know, all right, Squire, you got any rooms for the night? Yes, yes, why not? Come on in, you know. So, no, I don't see that quite meshing somehow. Richard continues... Interesting to hear Dave Homeward on your last podcast. I was a member of the New Zealand Dad's Army Appreciation Society for many years. It was quite a good newsletter, and he also used to produce a yearly calendar as well. Shame the society went under, but there just aren't enough real fans in New Zealand to keep it going. Well, we seem to be getting quite a few emails from New Zealand, mm-hmm. So perhaps yeah. if those New Zealand fans are out there, come on, let's get in touch, let's share some Dad's Army love. And who knows, maybe Dave will be resurrecting the New Zealand branch of the Appreciation Society, because it's good to spread the love of Dad's Army. Lastly, glad you have Oliver on board. Podcasts always work better when there are other people to talk to. Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to talk to James. What happened to the original offsider you had?
Well, I suppose that's worth addressing, actually. I mean, Tony helped me create the Dad's Army podcast. He put an awful lot of work into it in the early days, and he was basically overtaken by real life, unfortunately. I mean, it does happen. I know it's strange for some people to think, but both Oliver and I actually have jobs and we have lives, and we have to actually make time to record these things. I mean, this is fun, really. This is why we do it.
Oh, yeah. It's good to look forward to.
But it's something that neither of us will be able to do forever, I'm sure. Having said that, when I'm 70-odd now, you wait, I'll probably be recording episode 4,724. But we'll have to wait and see. But no, Tony will make it back to the podcast at some point. He's absolutely promised me that he will come back and talk about another episode, and I have to say it'd be really good to have both offsiders on board, so perhaps Tony will record some things with both myself and Oliver.
Absolutely, I'm all for that.
Okay, moving on to our next piece of feedback. Zola Brown from Taunton sends us an email. Hi James and Oliver, just a quick email to tell you how much I enjoy the latest podcast. They are really sounding so professional.
Well, no, it's thank you very much.
The Honourable Man is one of my favourite episodes. I was interested to hear your little discussion about the actor's rings, something I'd never noticed in the episode before. It does seem on first appearance a little strange that very few of the actors were wearing wedding rings when most of them were married in real life, but of course we must remember that 40 plus years ago it wasn't considered necessary for a man to wear a ring on his wedding finger. I think that's probably very true. It's much more of a generational thing as well, as opposed to a deliberate decision taken by the cast and crew. Put it this way, I got married nearly 3 years ago, and there was never a doubt that I was always going to wear a wedding ring.
Yes.
Whereas I think had I got married 40 years ago, well, one, it would have been an achievement because I wasn't born, but had...
He dropped that in nicely, didn't he?
I'm very young, you know, very young. But I think had I got married 40 odd years ago, then I don't think it would have been an automatic given that I would have worn a wedding ring. And perhaps we're just picking up on something here that isn't actually that relevant, perhaps. You never know. It's just fascinating to us when we go back and watch these programmes and notice the small little details.
It's probably a very delicate thing to approach someone about, to say, well, either can you take your wedding ring off for this, or will you wear one? I mean, it's quite a personal
thing. Yeah. I think they do it now. I think they do it in today's television, because they're so much more keen on getting detail correct. Yeah. And I think perhaps it would be addressed now. I really, really don't know. Anyway, Zola continues. Originally, the wedding ring was a symbol of a husband's ownership of his wife. Quite right, too. It was only... that was my comment, not
Zola's. That is, and nor mine. My girlfriend would probably headbutt them.
It was only in recent years that men started choosing to wear them. Pinky rings, a ring worn on the little finger, were first worn in the 1880s, but became fashionable from the 1950s onwards. I'm looking forward to your next podcast, which is this podcast, actually. The Man in the Hour is a lovely episode, and I especially love the start when all the platoon are back together after the war. I love the idea that Walker returned to see his friends after the war. What a pity James Beck died during the series. Anyway, I'm sure I've bored you long enough.
Not at all.
Please keep up the excellent work on the podcasts, and you're going to have to put a lot more effort in, Zola, if you want to try and bore Oliver and I about Dad's Army.
Absolutely. No, please keep writing, and it's lovely to hear someone from Taunton writing in. I'm a Plymouth boy myself, so let's get those West Country listeners writing in. And last but not least, an email from David Ryder. Hi, James. Thanks very much. That's fantastic. Well, that's good to know. What is fantastic? Oh, is he the winner?
He's the winner.
This is wonderful.
Yeah.
I thought I wouldn't win, so that's a great way to start the working day. I look forward to receiving the book and the next podcast. Thanks again. It's really appreciated. Best wishes, David.
That's David Ryder, who won a competition. Ooh, I think we launched that back in November last year, or should I say Nicholas Ridley launched it when we interviewed him.
I picked the number 37. That's right. I remember.
So there you are, David. You should be thanking Oliver rather than but I'd just like to say thank you to absolutely everybody who's written in. We have actually got a few more emails as well, but I think we've already gone through a significant number of this podcast, so we will go through them in a couple of months' time. Feel free to continue to send in your messages. It's always fascinating to hear your thoughts about Dad's Army, particularly when you pick up on small details, like we've spoken about wedding rings and, you know, poignancy of the ending of the series. So anything at all that you would like to hear Oliver and I discuss, then feel free to drop an email to us, james@dadsarmypodcast.com.
Please do, and like Dave did, send us in an MP3. Get the audio messages coming in, because, you know, we're all one big Dad's Army family here, and let's embrace it.
Absolutely, and it's an audio podcast, and if you record yourself with your comments, we don't have to read them out. So that's so that's even better. Just before we finish on the feedback this time round, I'd just like to refer to our website. Now, most of you, I'm sure, have seen our website at least once. It's dadsarmypodcast.com. Now, each of the episodes are listed one under the other on the website, and you're now able to leave comments directly on the website. There was a problem with that facility a little while ago that I've managed to solve now. So you don't need to sign in anymore. If those of you have tried to leave comments and have been asked to sign up to something, you don't need to do that anymore. You can just go on. You can leave it anonymously if you wish. Although if you're very rude, then I will delete it instantly. But do feel free to go in and leave some comments. And on our last podcast, we've had two comments, one of whom is from David Piper. And David says, just got back into these podcasts after a 9-month break. Forgot how good they were. Even better, in fact, than when I last listened to them. So that's good. That seems to be a running theme, that they're becoming more listenable. Certainly, maybe I'm becoming a little bit more technically proficient. Since I've met Oliver, I started drinking whilst I've been recording these things, and I think that's probably the secret, really. Keep up the fantastic work. Very enjoyable, David. Thank you very much indeed. And one last piece of feedback from Mark Goodacre. Just found a podcast after hearing a plug on the WhoCast. Loved the episode and have ordered the book by Nicholas Ridley. Looking forward to catching up on the other 43 episodes. Wow. Thank you so much for this podcast. Greatly appreciated. Mark, I hope you survive 43 podcasts all in one go. Good luck to you, mate. Right, moving on to, well, a segment that we haven't actually featured in the podcast for some time now. We're going to have a featured episode segment. This time we were talking about the very first episode of Dad's Army, The Man and the Hour.
And so, ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our guest of honour, one of Warmington-on-Sea's most distinguished citizens, a man of many parts, a banker, soldier, magistrate, alderman, and secretary of the Rotary Club. A good fellow all round. Ladies and gentlemen, Alderman George Mannering.
Chairman, Mr. Town Clerk, ladies and gentlemen. When I was first invited to be a guest of honour tonight at the launching of Warmington-on-Sea's I'm Becking Britain campaign, I accepted without hesitation. After all, I have always backed Britain.
Yeah.
I got into the habit of it in 1940. But then we all backed Britain.
Yeah.
It was the darkest hour in our history. The odds were absurdly against us, but young and old, we stood there, defiant, determined to survive, to recover, and finally, to win. The news was desperate, but our spirits were always high.
And we're back with the Dad's Army podcast. Now, you may remember on the last episode, I promised a very special guest to discuss the very first episode of The Man and the Hour. And I'm really pleased to say that all the way from the Flashing Blade podcast, Tony Galishon joins me now. Good evening, Tony.
Hello there, James. How's it going?
Not too bad, thank you. Well, I'm at the point of losing my voice, but aside from that...
You have a sniffle, don't you?
I have man flu, I think I've been told, so unfortunately I'm just going to have to plough on. So you may have to do a bit more talking than originally anticipated.
Oh, I couldn't possibly.
Tell the listeners a little bit about the Flash and Blade podcast before we get underway.
Okay, it's essentially a part work more than anything else. Each episode, which is weekly, we review a Doctor Who story, be it one on DVD or a Big Finish Doctor Who audio release. There's myself, there's my plucky girl assistant Joe, and latterly we've been joined by a young lad called Bob, who looks at the Big Finish stuff for us. It's a very, very silly. It's not a serious podcast at all. There's also an element of cult television and classic stuff. I think we played Wiggy's drum and bass remix of the Dad's Army theme a little while back. But, it's a hint of nostalgia, bit silly, but the good joy about it is that Jo doesn't know much about Doctor Who, so she's coming to it completely fresh and therefore giving all sorts of new opinions on things that I'm jaded over, quite frankly. And she tends to open people's eyes because of it. I'm hoping I'm going to do the same thing for this, because I don't know, much as I love Dad's Army, I don't know too much about it. So I've got a page full of notes here. see? And yes. Hopefully... yeah, we'll see how it goes, but apparently I'm the plucky girl assistant.
I'm going to have to admit to knowing far more about Dad's Army than is probably healthy. And so, yeah, between the two of us, we should provide quite a unique review of The Man and the Hour, really. Now, I've picked up a couple of Dad's Army references whilst listening to the Flashing Blade, Tony. So, I mean, how far back does your affection for the programme go?
Oh, childhood. It has to be childhood. Most people, I would have thought. Original run. Not the original series. I should imagine we're talking 71, 72, as far back as I can remember, really. There's something very... I'm trying to think of the correct word for this. Put it in perspective from where I'm coming from. If you look at the TARDIS, a blue police box, great. There's something very homely, very welcoming, very safe about it. Well, it's exactly the same with Dad's Army. You watch an episode of Dad's Army, you know you're going to be okay, quite frankly.
Now, indeed, it does kind of give that warm, fuzzy feeling.
Yeah.
And as a fan of both Doctor Who and Dad's Army, they do have the same kind of feel to them, if that makes sense. It feels like you're going back into a world where, you know,
my friends are there. I know these individual characters. And I think it's really interesting to take a look at the beginning of the series and see how everything began, because, of course, you can't suddenly create that kind of affection for characters and a programme overnight. It's got to be slowly built up. And Dad's Army wasn't particularly successful at doing that to start with. The reviews were, well, quite critical. They ranged from being extremely critical in terms of the acting, to the style and the genre that was chosen. You know, the war was still fairly fresh in people's minds in 1968, and people were a little bit concerned that people were sending up the war in an irreverent manner. But that did only last for a couple of years, and by about 1970-71, about the time you started watching it, by the sound of things, Tony, it had worked its way into British culture and had done incredibly well in terms of ratings. So looking back at the first episode then, this was broadcast originally on the 31st of July 1968 at 8:20 in the evening, to be precise, and attracted an audience of 7.2 million. Now, back in those days, that was still a relatively respectable audience.
Yes, yeah, very much.
But put yourself in the position, Tony. You turn the television on, you don't know what's coming on, and you see this pre-credit sequence, to use a modern-day expression, of a bunch of old gents sitting around a table. What was your first impressions?
I love that opening. I mean, it's the one thing, my little sort of dinner party fact, which shows what a sad, tiny little man I am, but the whole of Dad's Army is told in flashback.
Mm.
It's like, do you remember when, you know, our darkest hour? It's a brilliant opening. It places everything in context. This is how Britain now is. This is how it used to be and what had to happen to make it how it now is. I've got a couple of questions. Very quickly, just I want to place this in context for myself. The first episode that we see, I mean, I've got it on the, I think it's the Partwork DVD set. Is that restored and vidfired?
No, not at all. It's been redone slightly. The quality of the DVDs is significantly better than the transmitted versions. Even the repeats that go out today have not been touched at all. They've been cut occasionally. But the best things you can say about the DVDs is that they have been cleaned up to a degree, but certainly not vidfired. And they have been completely restored to, you know, in as much as they can be, their original script. And it's very, very rare these days that an episode goes out on BBC One or BBC Two that hasn't had a cut of some kind.
Fascinating. Quick explanation to anybody who doesn't know what vidfire is. It's a restoration process for certain archive pieces of television, for which the videotapes no longer exist, but a film copy does. What the vidfire process does is it drops extra frames into the process and makes things look like they're on video, like they should be, rather than on film. There we go. See? Full of information. I'll shut up now. It's a great opening. Another question, very quickly, again to place this into context. Is the first episode that we see, The Man in the Hour, is it a pilot? Is it the first episode? Or was the show filmed out of sequence? So it's like the fourth show filmed or something?
No, it was filmed in order. It was not a pilot. There were six episodes commissioned. And the story of how that actually happened is really quite interesting. I mean, I won't go into huge details now because you can make a podcast out of that in itself. But essentially, Jimmy Perry had this fantastic idea that was, you know, it was a great idea. Everybody thought it was a good idea, but it was an idea from someone who hadn't had any experience in producing television programs. So David Croft was brought in, who was an established producer, director. He was pretty much a stalwart at the BBC and essentially mentored Jimmy Perry. But yeah, essentially it was always going to have the six episodes. All of the actors were signed up for six episodes, and it was never a case of, yeah, we'll just run this one episode and we'll make some more if it happens to be successful. I'm not so sure whether that kind of thing happened as frequently as it does today. I think series were commissions as opposed to individual episodes back in the 60s.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was far more a a free rein for creative talents back at the BBC back then. Nowadays, of course, it's focus groups and committees and this, that, and the other. And, well, right, we'll try one out just to see. But no, yes, you'd be turned around and say, yes, there you go, there's some money, go and make a six-part series. That, like you say, it's the first episode, it's not a pilot, it's the one they went straight into the studio and recorded. That is amazing, because it is such a confident production, quite frankly. I was watching it thinking, this looks like it could be any episode of a show that's been going for quite a few years. It, I mean, it's all right. It has a certain freshness to it because it's the first episode. But it's so well made, and the actors are so in touch with their characters that, like I say, it could be any episode in that respect. It's just probably one of the most confident opening episodes of a series I've seen.
I think it was probably because Jimmy Perry had such a definite idea of what these characters were going to be like right from the very start. I think there was some character development throughout the 9 years that Dad's Army was on television. And I think if you were to watch, for instance, well, Pike is the most obvious, I think.
And Mannering, I would say.
Mannering's attitude changes, and it changes. It's not necessarily consistent, and I'm not entirely convinced it was deliberate in terms of what the writers were trying to do. I think a lot of it, depending on how Arthur Lowe felt on any given day.
Is it the Bill Hartnell problem?
Quite possibly, yeah. I think Arthur Lowe was an established actor. He came in basically feeling that he was in charge. If you listen to a lot of the surviving cast today tell their stories, it's a very much a case that what Arthur wanted to do or what Arthur didn't want to do, and that included learning his lines, was actually the way things developed, and it defined the show. And I think the real talent there of Jimmy Perry and David Croft is that they looked at Arthur Lowe, they saw what he was good at and what he wasn't, and actually wrote scripts around his speech patterns, his natural mannerisms. And this is one of the very few programmes, I think, where eventually, by the end of it, the characters and the actors were interwoven at the end. They were very, very much the same thing, which is interesting. Anyway, going back to the beginning of the episode, let me ask you a question now, Tony.
You're drifting.
I'm very good at that. This is the problem, you see. You get someone asking me questions about Dad's Army, and then I'll just go on and on for ages.
Now I know how Joe feels.
Going back to the opening sequence. Just before the credits come up for the very first time. Now, that is supposed to be a contemporary scene. Now, people will argue as to when it was set, because if you notice, there was no Jones in that particular sequence. Now, everybody's assumed it's because he's died, because the character he plays in the first episode is notably more decrepit than he is portrayed later on in this series.
Yeah.
However, Godfrey is there.
And Godfrey was always aged up a little bit, yeah.
Yes, indeed. So if that was supposed to be 1968, which was the broadcast date of that particular episode, and the war finished, as we know, in 1945...
I can't believe you had to stop and think about that.
Oh, it's all numbers to me. All numbers. And Godfrey, let's say, was 70. He would have been closing on 90 in that scene. So there's no reason as to why they couldn't have had the character of Jones there. So it's interesting if you try and actually put a specific date on when that scene was set.
What did Croft and Perry say?
I don't think they gave it a terrific amount of thought.
Good on them.
Which I think is quite good. The way I see it is that it is set clearly after the war, but I think it's not necessarily in 1968.
But does Jones have to be alive? In all fairness, I mean, someone can outlive somebody else.
Absolutely, that's very true. Are we just trying to retcon?
Of course we are. We're fans. That's what we do. It's the law.
But of course, James Beck was there, and he died and disappeared. The character of Walker disappeared.
Did we ever find out what actually happened to the character of Walker?
No, they were very, very careful about how they addressed that. And I think it was done extremely well in hindsight. And given the time in which his programme was made, it wasn't automatically an obvious thing to explain. The episode in which he was scripted and unfortunately he couldn't star in was The Recruit, and that was series 6, so they allocated a lot of Walker's lines to other characters and then came up with a brand new scene that explained that he was in the smoke doing a deal, which of course works perfectly well for Walker, and then he's never referred to again. And some people say that's very sad, other people say that's as it should have been, because James Beck's death reportedly did affect the cast and crew incredibly, because it's essentially a programme that's, you know, staffed by old age pensioners as the main cast, and the youngest guy dies.
That's something else I love about this particular show. All the catchphrases are there. All the running gags are there in that very first episode. The obvious one, stupid boy. He doesn't call Pike a stupid boy, but he refers to Pike as a stupid boy. Don't be a stupid boy or something like that. It's all there. Permission to speak, sir. Jones coming in late with his drill movements. You know, hello there, sir. Godfrey just being too polite, quite frankly. Yes. Wilson, would you mind awfully? It's everything is there. It's absolutely wonderful. Talking about which, who plays Sergeant Wilson?
John Lemessurier.
Say that again?
John Lemessurier.
I'm from Jersey. It's Lemessurier.
There's a big debate about whether or not you call him Lemessurier, Lemessurier, or
Lemessurier.
However you just said it. Yes. He always pronounced it Lemessurier. John Lemessurier.
Oh, well, they come over here from Jersey. Dear me. Oh, we better anglicise ourselves. It's Lemessurier.
Well, whilst we're on the cast, did you happen to notice a chap called Bracewell?
Yes, I was going to ask, what happened to that character?
Well, he was a character who was always intended to be a staple member of the platoon, and it was decided, in hindsight, that probably 8 members of the regular cast was slightly too many, and also that his character was very similar to Godfrey.
Right.
So he was written out. But do you happen to recognise him, given your affection for Doctor Who? He represents the single most significant crossover between the two shows.
Oh, yes, yes, most definitely. I recognise him, and you're going to tell everybody who it was.
It's John Ringham was the actor, and the most famous role, I think, within Doctor Who was La Toxel in the Aztecs.
Yep.
He did actually reappear in Series 3 and Series 4 a couple of times as Captain Bailey, because obviously he was slightly aggrieved that he was written out of what became a hugely successful programme. And he was promised by Perry and Croft the odd part here and there to make up for it. And they were completely honest to that, and they let him come back every now and again. And he died recently, actually. He died last year.
Going back to the show, you've got the opening titles, and the laughter over them just seems very misplaced. Now, I appreciate it's how things were done at the time. You'd put your episode together, and you'd probably show it to an audience and then record the laughter. So they were obviously recording the laughter of them showing the title sequence. But it don't know what it is. It just, something about it just doesn't quite click.
Yeah, it definitely does feel slightly strange. It was the only episode in that first series where you did have an audience laughter track over the titles. And my only, and I'm not sure if this is true, but my only theory is that it was actually being shown to a live audience on a TV monitor. So this is the very first time that they'd ever seen the Dad's Army opening titles. And if you try and watch it through fresh eyes, it is actually reasonably funny.
Well, yes, especially for that sort of audience at that sort of time. There's the British Expeditionary Force walking its way through France, and suddenly Hitler's Germany turns up and kicks them back over the Thames. Over the Thames? What am I saying? Over the Channel. The newsreel. I like that, because it says a lot. It points to just how pants Jones really is. I mean, all the enthusiasm is there, but oh dear. And it also shows you exactly just how bloodthirsty Fraser is, quite frankly, because he's sitting there, he's standing there, he's sharpening his sort of the spike for the parachute to land on, and he loves it. He just knows, I'm going to get somebody. It's, yeah. Poor old Fraser.
Indeed. I mean, I love the newsreel, and that was something that was present throughout the entire run of black and white episodes. However, the first 6 episodes, the first series, intercut it with genuine real pieces of newsreel that was set from that were shown during the war. And that for me really does add something to the black and white episodes for me that is lost when they started broadcasting in colour. And I think that was grounding the comedy within a wartime scenario, and they do that so effectively within the first series.
Over the couple of, you've got the couple of black and white series, you've got the newsreel and this, that and the other. So the first series grounds it in the war. Second one, you've got the fake newsreel, and then the third one, which is in colour, it's already a success. So do they actually need to bring the newsreel in then?
I don't think they need to bring it in, but they certainly needed to be conscious of the fact that they were still dealing with sensitive material. And the way I think that they addressed that was, rather than doing it as directly as they did in the first two series with the newsreel, was to get absolutely every single wartime detail absolutely spot on. Mm-hmm. And if you do the research, and there's an awful lot of Dad's Army fans out there who do, every time something is mentioned, for instance, how much it costs at a particular time for a particular brand of tobacco, it's accurate. And that's Jimmy Perry. And well, it is scary, given that they made 80 episodes and there's only a couple of mistakes. And they are
again,
very, very few and far
between.
It
shows the commitment and professionalism. And it, again, it shows just why. Little things like that build up and they make a success of something.
Yeah, absolutely right. And they didn't actually need to spend that amount of detail on it, to be honest with you, because there were several other wartime comedy series that sprung up later that didn't show that respect, if you like, to the fact that it's a comedy set in a tragic set of circumstances. But let's talk a little bit about Ian Lavender. I'm a big fan of Ian Lavender in pretty much whatever it is that he stars in. I mean, I think he'll always be tainted with Pike to a degree, but didn't he look young in this particular episode?
Just. And I love the fact he puts on a voice that's sort of only just broken.
Yes.
As well. I mean,
which he keeps. He keeps that voice all the way up until, ooh, let me think now. That must be the first few episodes in series three.
Goodness. I like the way he plays it very, very well. You can tell there's talent there. I mean, was the Ian Lavender's big break?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
And they picked the right person for that. And I like the fact that, again, first episode, and they've got the whole Wilson-Pike relationship just right. You know what's going on there. There's a couple of very loaded sentences. You know, will you be around for your usual after, Arthur? Little things like that. Yeah, you can see it there.
you can see, I think, the thought process from Jimmy Perry. He put an awful lot of work into this.
Yeah.
And he was absolutely determined to make it a success. But at the same time, I think they dropped things that they believed didn't work as the episodes and as the series panned out. And Bracewell, we've already talked about. And also Miss King, the character of Janet King, played brilliantly, I think, by Caroline Dowdeswell, features as Pike's colleague within the bank.
Yes. I was going to say, I love the way we come out of the newsreel. It goes straight into this beautiful mix of the domestic and the war. Mm. You've got Mannering in his bank, being king of his little empire, piling up sandbags. Poor old Pike having to go down to the beach to get them. And like I said, it's this bizarre thing. It's a case they're talking about the field of fire of this, of, well, nothing really, but there's a good field of fire, whatever. And they got talking about, you know, I don't know the names of the shops, but, you know, from Jones Butcher down to the Undertaker's thing.
Stead and Stimpson's. That's and Smithy White's.
Yes, not the Novelty Rock Emporium, which I think glorious load of words. The Novelty Rock Emporium. That is wonderful. But there's this beautiful, like I say, juxtaposition between the domestic and the war. And that goes throughout the run, I think.
No, you're absolutely spot on. You're completely right. And it's one of the real strengths, because when you start seeing a scene set within, either in one of the characters' houses, it can be as explicit as that, you know, a physical scene set within a domestic environment, or when they start talking about their private lives, you know, within a parade, for instance, you're instantly drawn in. I was anyway, and you know, it's you're intrigued to know what's going on, and you follow these characters' lives throughout their, you know, their work and their normal lives pre-war almost, and then when you see what the war actually does to them, you can see that it is all-consuming and it changes absolutely everything. And it's absolutely amazing the way that they're able to focus on that throughout the entire series. I think you're absolutely right.
I think you sort of say the way the war changes. For Mannering, it's his time come. Yes, he's got his own little thing, but that's all he'd ever be. He'd only ever be a bank manager. He'd be in the Rotary Club. He probably might end up in local politics if it wasn't a little bit too grubby for him. But this is his moment to shine. And the thing about Mannering is, he is capable. All right, he's wrapped up in himself. But it's all for the right reasons. I mean, look at his improvisation skills. Yes. He turns around to Pike and basically goes, you're the information officer. Go out and tell people. Well, I've got a megaphone. And he just punches out a coal scuttle and says, there you go. There's your megaphone. Straight away, improvisation.
Absolutely.
He's wonderful at that. And it's a case of, is that what people were like back then? Mm. I'm not saying were they just like mannering. But have we lost nowadays the ability to improvise because everything's spoon-fed to us?
That's an incredibly good question. And do I think attitude has changed within culture? Mm. Yes, absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt. And do I ever think we're ever going to see the kind of wartime spirit that is demonstrated within Dad's Army? No, I don't think that will ever happen, because we're never going to go through a similar kind of experience people did in World War II. If we end up getting involved in a world war, it'll be very quick and it'll be very different.
I agree.
I think, yeah. But with Mannering in particular, his character changes and develops, and I think this is another strength of the programme.
Again, I was going to ask about this, because apart from the fact that nothing will get in his way, he will do what he sees is right for to protect his country. But Mannering's character is deeper than that. There's a depth. There's his marriage. I mean, the poor man is doomed to this sort of very large shape in the top bunk. It's just... you've got to feel sorry for him. And every now and again, Croft and Perry would come out with an episode for Arthur Lowe which enabled him to just show that other little facet to Mannering. Whether it was with his dalliance with a brief encounter affair, or the... when his brother turns up.
Oh, yeah, you're talking about two absolutely fascinating and brilliant episodes. Well, two of my favourite.
It shows Mannering off to be slightly different. It fills him out. It rounds him off. There's more depth to Mannering than you'd get in quite a few things, I would think.
Mm. And I think Arthur Lowe plays to those scripts brilliantly.
Yes.
And, you know, he was the one who complained when he got those scripts. The brief encounter episode you're talking about is one called Mum's Army. And that featured Carmen Silvera as Mannering's love interest. She played a character called Mrs. Gray. And when he read that the first time, this is the story that goes around. He went up to Jimmy Perry and said, "This particular episode is, you know, just not as good, not as funny as usual." And by the time he got round to performing the scenes and at the end, he changed his mind. And he said, "This is one of the best scripts that I've ever had to learn and perform."
Well, from what I gather, having seen things, a lot of the cast weren't particularly over enamoured with the work they were doing. Would I be right in saying that? I can't remember his name. The actor who played Fraser,
John Laurie.
Thank you very much, John Laurie. Was a little bit resentful that he achieved big time fame through Dad's Army.
So the story goes. Now, how true that is, I think, you know, is left open to interpretation. But Jimmy Perry gets up at events these days and says, you know, John Laurie spent an entire career, you know, within, you know, the Royal Shakespeare Company, featuring in some really, really, you know, very successful films with Laurence Olivier. And he gets to about 78 or however old he was. He wasn't that old, but he was the same age pretty much as Arnold Ridley. And he becomes a household name with this rubbish, in quotation marks. And it's always said to try and get a laugh, but how true it is that he really felt like that, I don't think we'd ever really know.
Questions. More questions. Mm. I've got tons and tons of questions about this first episode. Wilson, was he a sergeant or captain? Because in the first episode, he says he was a sergeant. However, in the last episode, he actually was a captain.
Very, very well noticed. And yes, both of those are accurate, I think. I think he was a sergeant at one point,
well,
and later on he became
ranks.
A captain. I think that's the only way of interpreting it, because there's a number of issues like that where the writers don't pay as much attention to things that they've scripted in the past. And I think that, you know, those two episodes you're talking about were 9 years apart. And I don't think they went back to check to see whether or not they'd already established a backstory for Wilson. And they make similar errors with Fraser's character in terms of his occupation as well.
Yes, because he says he's not a philatelist. I can't remember what it was.
It was
a philatelist.
Was, yeah.
And then he becomes an undertaker.
Well, on the way to becoming an undertaker, he is a manufacturer of coffins, but he doesn't actually go ahead as an undertaker. Well, it is. Within the... again, this is probably a little bit too anal, perhaps, but in the episode No Spring for Fraser, he basically says, well, I'm not what I told you I was. And Mannerin, for some strange reason, turns around and says, well, I thought you were a fisherman. So Fraser's had about three or four different jobs. He's either a philatelist, unless he was lying there to cover up the fact that he made coffins, or he was a fisherman at some point.
Hang on. Do we actually know what a philatelist is?
Stamps, I believe.
Well, that's what I thought. But, I mean, how can you have a job which is stamps?
That's a good point. Maybe he worked in a post office.
How old was Clive Dunn when this was recorded?
Oh, he was within his 40s. He was in his 40s. I couldn't tell you the exact age, but he'd made a career out of playing characters who are older than him. Indeed, up, as had David Jason up until that point, and David Jason was the first...
Porridge. What happened to Sponge? When did Sponge come in?
Colin Bean starred in... Oh, I feel like I'm on some kind of mastermind here.
I did say I had questions.
Colin Bean starred in all but four episodes. So he was pretty much present throughout the entire run. Right. It was only in an episode called All Is Safely Gathered In that he was given a little bit of backstory and started getting a few lines. And in the final series, he got a line every single episode.
Why did Walker join the platoon? I'm watching this, I'm thinking to myself, any pops? Why? This is the sort of thing, ordinarily, someone like himself would go, no, I don't think that's for me. Except he does. And I'm thinking to myself, is it the only way he can possibly give himself the glimmer of respectability to cover up for the fact that basically he's dodging the draft?
Oh, I think that might be a bit too magnanimous. I think he thought he could make a quick buck out of a whole new captive audience. In fact, there's a scene within the first scene.
Oh, you cynic.
Maybe, but he manages to sell Bracewell a watch.
Yes, I was going to say, that's a brilliant little scene, because you've got the usual thing of Mannering going around at the start of each episode, inspecting the platoon. So he inspects the front row, which is all the show's stars, then goes off to inspect the rest of it. So they've got to cover that, because it would be a bit dull to keep watching the rest of it. So they do this wonderful little scene where Walker sells a watch to Bracewell and just turns and says, here, hold that taffy. And the look John Lurie gives Walker when he calls him taffy, he's like, what? It's... If looks could kill, quite frankly. But that's a great little scene, a great little piece of writing. There's also another good little bit... I think it's when Bill Pertwee's ARP warden turns up. And he turns around, I think it's Mannering? Turns around and goes, do you realise history is taking place in there? I mean, how apt was that line when you think about it? Not just history within its own little context there, but the fact that television history was taking part as well. It was the first sort of meeting of the Warmington-on-Sea Home Guard. It's, it's interesting stuff. One thing I do miss, having watched this, I miss hats. Why don't we wear more hats? Also, Mannering. He talks about his service in World War... Well, the year after World War One. Was he actually a captain? Because they automatically... HQ automatically... Well, there we go, Captain Mannering. Should he have had that rank?
Well, first of all, there is an episode that actually addresses that very fact called Room at the Bottom, and that's in Series 3. And that was the episode that was lost. One of the episodes that was lost. It was recovered in black and white, and a couple of years ago it was actually restored to colour using a fascinating technique that they've since gone ahead and used again to restore a couple of Doctor Who episodes from black and white to colour.
It's amazing the work they do, these guys. The restoration team are just, wow, boffins of the First Order.
Well, this was something to do with the chroma dots, and it was a guy called James Ansell at the BBC. Absolutely fascinating. But anyway, getting back to your point, no, he wasn't a legitimate captain. And that was something that was questioned, as I said, in Room at the Bottom, and he was busted. He was eventually busted all the way back down to private.
I remember, yes.
Yes. And eventually
Did Fraser take over, or did...
So many different references. Yes, you're referring to another episode called If the Cap Fits, which is where Mannering allowed Fraser to take over the platoon because he was troublemaking too much. But yes, that's slightly different to Room at the Bottom, where Wilson gets temporary charge of the platoon and makes an absolute hash of it, which is brilliantly done. Absolutely brilliantly done. But all of these episodes that you're mentioning, you're picking out the cream of each of the series. You know, they're very, very good episodes indeed.
Well, that good. They sort of stick in the mind, really, don't they?
No, they do.
That's one thing that Dad's Army does. It does stick in the mind. You watch an episode and, oh yeah, bang, straight away, you just remember just little snippets of it.
Indeed, sometimes incredibly subconsciously, because you find yourself quoting lines from the episodes in everyday speech sometimes. Well, I do anyway.
Yes, I walk into the shop and say, would you mind awfully giving me a... You know? No. And one thing I do like, right at the very, very end, you've got the Coldstream Guards playing their version of the theme tune, and right at the end you've got the air raid siren, except it's the all clear, which basically says, yep, don't worry, everything's okay.
Yes.
Which is,
yes,
again, well chosen. They could easily have put the air attack siren on, but they didn't. They put the all clear on. I still hate that noise, but, child of the 80s, you can't help it. But it's just a nice choice again. It's a case of, yep, everything's fine. Don't worry. I want Wilson's great coat from that last episode. I think that's a wonderful coat. I like big flappy coats.
I was going to say, you've got this thing about coats, haven't you?
Yes, big flappy coats. Ruined for us all by John Barrowman. But, we can't wear big flappy coats anymore. It's just not right. To sum up for myself, watching that first episode, especially if you compare it to the movie version, which I should imagine we've all seen more of than we would have done the original television version. It's amazing how well that opening episode stands up, and it sets the foundations for that show solidly. And quite frankly, like I say, it's one of the most confident openings to a series I've ever seen, quite frankly. Hats off to Croft and Perry for that, and also to the cast. I mean, these guys were firing on all cylinders when they did that. It's amazing. You're watching an acting masterclass, quite frankly.
And when you consider that you have got half an hour or so, and it consists solely of three studio-bound scenes.
Yeah.
You know, there's got to be something there to hold the attention, and it does it effortlessly. When you sit there and watch this, now I've seen this more times than I can possibly, remember, but it still doesn't drag for me. There are some episodes of Dad's Army that do drag a little bit, but the opening episode is one that grabs my attention all the time, and I notice different things about it each time I watch it. For instance, Godfrey wears glasses occasionally. I notice the fact that Jones looks so much older than he did later on in the series. And, just small little things like that. It's great to go back and revisit this particular episode.
I've got a favour to ask. I hope you don't mind. It's a favour to ask of your listeners. If you can do a really good impersonation of any of the Dad's Army cast, can you get in touch with me, please? If I can give my email address out. Is that right? show@flashingblade.org.uk. Quite simply, I want to put together a little sketch featuring, as near as damn it, the Warmington-on-Sea Home Guard. The one I really need is Mannering. Preferably Wilson, Jones, Godfrey, possibly. I'm not going to say what it is. It's basically we're going to do a well-known song. And it's going to be Mannering telling the story of this song to the Warmington-on-Sea Home Guard. But I can't do the voices. I'm good at some voices, but I can't do any voices from Dad's Army. I'm hopeless. So please get in touch. show@flashingblade.org.uk.
Okay, well, I'll look forward to listening to that, Tony, certainly. But anyway, thank you very much indeed for joining me for the last half an hour or so. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show, especially after we've been promising to have you on for such a long time now.
Thank you. I've thoroughly enjoyed myself. It's given me a chance to be in a totally different position to the one I'm normally in. Normally, I'm the one spouting off all sorts of nonsense and sitting there and coming out with obscure facts and this, that and the other. And I'm on the other end of it this time, and it's been fascinating too. I learned stuff from this. Useless stuff, but it's good stuff.
Indeed. And we're going to play out quite appropriately with Tony in a promo for The Flashing Blade. Bye for now.
Advertisement break.
I'm Barry Scott.
Ooh, that was a bit noisy. Hello, this is a promo for the Flashing Blade podcast. I'm Tony, and this is my plucky girl assistant, Jo.
Hello.
That was a bit breathy, Kensington Miss, wasn't it?
Hello. Anyway, what do we do? What do we talk about?
Oh, we talk about stuff and things.
And things?
Yeah, in equal measures.
Stuff and things. Doctor Who, science fiction, all sorts of silly stuff like that, but mainly Doctor Who, because it's my obsession. I'm the ancient wise one, and Joe knows, well, bugger all really about it.
I'm the plucky one, apparently, allegedly.
Yes, she's very, very, very plucky. We get Joe's completely fresh views on all sorts of things to do with Doctor Who and my ancient, ingrained, indefinable magic views. So that's the Flashing Blade podcast, available from www.flashingblade.org.uk, iTunes, podcast, Ali, blah, 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 blah,
blah, blah, blah.
That's the end of this promo. Toodles!
Bye!
Well, I, for one, am very jealous that I wasn't there for Tony's feedback on The Man of the Hour. That was fantastic listening.
No, it was a lot of fun. It had a very different dynamic because Tony is not as passionate about Dad's Army as you heard from the discussion as you or I, but he loves the programme and he's got an exceptionally good way of analysing the construction of a particular episode. And I think because this was the very first episode, he noticed things that I'd never noticed before. Yeah. And I just thought it was very, very interesting listening to him. And he kept on putting me on the spot, asking so many different questions. I had to edit that very, very subtly to make it look like I had the answer right on the tip of my tongue.
Well, you always do, Jen. No editing required. Well, if you would like to get in touch and let us know your thoughts on Tony's opinions or anything else you've heard on this podcast, please email james@dadsarmypodcast.com. Mm. And we will no doubt feature your thoughts later on in the series.
Do take a little while getting to the feedback every now and again. We do get to every single piece of feedback. We do read it out eventually. Can be 2 or 3 months after you send it in sometimes. That's because we've got other segments that we need to get through. But we do read absolutely everything, and I do my absolute best to respond to as many as I possibly can. I don't always manage it these days because we have fortunately got so much feedback coming in. Don't forget, you can also follow the Dad's Army podcast blog. I don't update it as regularly as I should, but I intend to, certainly over the next few weeks, because there's been quite a bit of Dad's Army news I'd like to update you all on. That's www.dadsarmypodcast.blogspot.com. And of course, you can follow us on Twitter. That's twitter.com/Dad's Army Podcast. And you can follow Oliver on Twitter now as well, can't
yeah,
you?
You can. I'm still getting to grips with the thing, but yeah, you sure. I'll tweet, you know, come and tweet to me.
How do they tweet you? What's your Twitter page, Oliver?
Oh, it's Oliver Crocker. Yeah, so come and find me on Twitter, and you can tell me how it works.
Anyway, thank you once again for spending the last wall. This has probably been about an hour and 10 minutes or so now, this podcast. So thank you for listening. Thank you, Oliver, for joining me once again.
It's always an enormous pleasure. Thank you for putting up with me.
it's an honour for me as well. So anyway, before we say goodbye, one last thing. What's up on the next podcast?
On the next podcast, do we have a treat for you? You've been enjoying our commentary episodes of late. I can officially say the Dad's Army podcast is bringing you a very first. We have a commentary on an episode with a member of the cast. You are going to be listening to The Royal Train with James, myself, and the legend, the epic legend that is Frank Williams, the Reverend Timothy Farthing. Frank joins us for a commentary. It's never been done. No one has ever had a member of the cast sit down and talk about an episode of Dad's Army, and you will all be the first people to hear it. So join us next time for episode 46.
Bye for now.
We are the boys who will stop your little game. We are the boys who will make you think again. 'Cause who do you think?
This next one is from Australia also, different part though, Adelaide. Is Adelaide near Brisbane?
Oh. You're asking a Luddite when it comes to geography, I'm afraid, in my ignorance.
Okay, well, in our ignorance as well, I'm going to say Adelaide is very close to Brisbane. And Robin, you really ought to go and have a word with Dennis, because you've got some things in common with Dad's Army.